Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on this Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you, as always.
I appreciate that, and what a week it has been. There is
boring.
There is so much going on, and so much that we just don't understand, but I guess we'll start with the following. We have, over the last, I don't know how many months at this point, encouraged people to continue to thank and laud Senator Menendez of New Jersey because of his stand regarding sanctions in Iran. It seems he took a turn on that issue this week. Could you tell us what he said, what he plans on doing, and if we should temper our thanks a bit toward the senator?
No, his leadership remains very significant. He's taken the issue of the sanctions building, the additional sanctions, I should say. And what's happened this week is really misunderstood to a degree. He didn't back off support, but he did call on his fellow Democrats, in a sense, to wait until the March 23rd, 24th, whatever the deadline they set. But in fact, the Senate calendar would have dictated that the issue wouldn't have come up, the bill couldn't have come up until March, and what they assured is that it would be taken up immediately. It essentially gave the White House a deadline. The White House can claim, get satisfaction for the fact that they bought this time, but it says to them now, you said you needed the time, that if this passed, it would sabotage the negotiations, and obviously the Iranians would have played that to the hilt. So now the onus is there. You have a deadline. The Senate Banking Committee yesterday marked up the bill, so it isn't that the process is dead or has stopped. It will continue. The markup was passed 18-4, which was way beyond what the expectations were. And in fact, if you judge by that, and some of the senators who had not previously endorsed the legislation or taken a position supported the bill in the committee, the feeling is that there are now enough votes, or there's 66 of the 67 pretty much locked in. Now we want to hear from a few others, including some from this area, like Senator Gillibrand, Senator Booker, who haven't yet indicated that they will support this bill when it comes up in March.
Boy, did the media paint this differently than you're telling us.
Well, because, you know, they want to show that it doesn't have the support. It is true that a lot of pressure was...
No, not just that. They wanted to show us that there's a White House victory, that the pressure from Washington was able to get them to postpone.
Well, I said to you that the White House will certainly claim satisfaction for the postponement.
Right.
There was a lot of pressure brought to bear. I don't think that anybody should be punished, because if you know the inner workings and you know what the schedule would be anyway,
right,
it is not such a vast change.
So when Senator...
Would we have preferred that this thing be passed right away and the White House and the Congress work together and just agree and go to the Iranians and say, listen, here's the message that if you continue to stall, the word is that they are stalling on all of this. On this, they stall.
Right.
On their aggressiveness in the region, they never stall. So, I think that there is some misrepresentation about what really happened.
So when Senator Schumer and others, Gillibrand and Booker were still waiting for, as you mentioned, but when Senator Schumer and others, and it's a pretty impressive list, joined as co-sponsors this week, this was significant. This was not jumping onto a bill that's now drifting away. This is, as you would describe, just as strong as it was earlier.
The bill remains strong.
Right.
The
timing's a bit different.
That the timing is different. And again, I agree that if the Iranians read this in that way, then it's a bad thing, because then they say that, look, the White House has undermined the support that the Menendez, who wrote the letter to his colleagues, isn't as supportive. He is as supportive, and if you read his statements, you see that he remains committed to passing it. And their feeling is that it will be easier now to get a veto-proof majority in March by virtue of the steps that were taken.
Right, and the numbers indicate that. All right, since we're talking about Washington, so true or false, true or false that President Obama has sent an army of personnel to Tel Aviv to work on ousting Benjamin Netanyahu on the 17th of March?
No, I don't think that the president sent them. There are people who have gone who have worked for the president. Some of whom are now working, I think, on the Clinton campaign. I haven't checked the other people. I know of one. But the charge that's being made is that these people who work for them are going now to work for a group called, I think it's called One Vote,
right?
Which has received funding from the State Department, supposedly for to rally support for the Kerry Initiative. So I have questions about whether that is a legitimate allocation of taxpayers' funds to work in another country to influence the public opinion. I guess it's done in many places, so the only, and I know members of Congress are going to be looking into this. The question is not whether...
Who's been brave enough to announce that they're going to look into it?
Oh, some members of Congress already said that.
Including Democrats?
Well, yes, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Because
okay.
It's a question of the allocation of funds
right.
to an organization that's engaged in such partisan activity, influencing American policy. If the Knesset had allocated money to an organization in America that's working against the Kerry Initiative, let's say, to influence American public opinion on it, I think that there would be an outcry and you know, calls for an investigation by the Knesset, as well as probably by some Americans.
Right. All right. So for those of us who are going to be at the Shabbos table tonight, and the discussion will be the meddling of Washington in the Israeli election, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much meddling is there?
Well, you know, there's direct and indirect meddling. There's ways that you can communicate messages aside from this this charge about One Vote, which
right.
I do think is a serious issue to look into.
Yeah.
It has happened in the past, in the Clinton years, other years, where you've had, you know, activities supported by European governments, by American governments, by others, that I think, you know, cross traditional lines and even acceptable lines. Do I think that the administration would like to see somebody else at the helm? Yes, I think so. I think they've made pretty clear where they stand.
With that in mind, if there was no election in March, would the White House have been as insulted with the way the Boehner invitation to Netanyahu and the acceptance of that invitation came down? Would it have been as big of an issue if there was not an election coming up?
Well, for them, yes. I think that the... Look, the tensions are very clear between the administration and the prime minister, or president and the prime minister. It's unfortunate for both sides. This is not something that's good for America. It's good for Israel. It's not good for either. And it's something I told the president in our first meeting 6 years ago, that there shouldn't be public daylight because the enemies of both countries exploit it. And it mm-hmm. undermines, I will tell you, for Arab countries, their faith in what they can expect from America, because they do believe the myths about, you know, Jewish control, the Israel lobby, all of these things. And they say, if Israel can't rely on the United States, what chance do we have? And when we see all of the enemies that are arising in the region to America, the attitude towards the United States, even on the part of some of our so-called allies in the Arab world, this is a bad message. You don't show this kind of public dispute. And one can legitimately argue that it was not handled right and there should have been clearance, and Boehner now says that he did call the White House just before. You know, if the relationship were different, none of these things would be happening, and I think it's too important. You know, I know the media loves it. I know there are people who love to get into this and to discuss it. The fact is that I think it's painful. It's not acceptable to have this kind of tension that makes every issue a huge, or that the prime minister, and I saw a piece that really changed my thinking on it, and essentially it argued the moral responsibility that if the prime mm-hmm. minister gets an invitation like this, and how it came about, we'll learn, and the process, I think, you know, is something that the books will be written about and people legitimately can question, but the moral responsibility that if in 1939 the head of a Jewish state then would have been given the opportunity to talk to the members of Congress about what was happening in Europe.
Right.
When you see Iran as an existential danger, do you pass up the opportunity to speak to the most powerful body in the world
right.
to make your case as an educational thing?
With that in mind, will the speech happen?
Right now, the speech will happen in March. Will it ultimately happen? I would say 70% yes.
And the Israeli media's role in all this, we know it's been happening here. We know the reaction from Washington. I asked if there was an election, would it have been as severe, etc. The Israeli media is feasting on this, right? They're calling Bibi to task for embarrassing the Israeli people in Washington.
Well, most of the media there is not pro-Netanyahu,
right.
Not pro-good. So this is fodder for them. So one, they took a few days off of focusing on Mrs. Netanyahu and start focusing on this. I'm not saying it's not a legitimate issue. I think there are legitimate questions that can be raised about the process, about what happened. But the they beat them up on everything at a time when we have the problems in the north. You have so many other issues that are prevalent. And should be the focus of everybody's attention.
Well, you're right. And with that in mind, I ask you, the last time you were in the Prime Minister's house, did you notice an inordinate number of empty bottles in any of the corners of the home?
And that they order small bottles of water because you get a bigger refund on them than on the big bottles of water.
If you're, by the way, don't do it now, folks. You don't want to miss the rest of the weekly update. But you can Google Netanyahu bottles and you'll see the latest scandal, quote-unquote, in Israel. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, broadcasting live from the Sonia and Robert Gold studios in Jersey City, New Jersey, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Special hello to those tuned in on the NSN app from anywhere around the world. Let's go backwards on the story, this terrible tragedy up north. And the reason I say it like that in terms of going backwards is, let's start with today's news, then we'll go back to the episode itself. Is there now an official ceasefire, some type of agreement between Israel and Hezbollah for quiet on the northern border?
It would appear so. It would appear that the there's a temporary lull. It would be more likely that the after the Israeli strike, the Hezbollah now can claim that they retaliated, that they got their revenge with the killing of the two soldiers. And they did send messages to the Israelis that they want to de-escalate it. They don't want an all-out war, which it looked like they were heading towards. And it seems that Israel, for the time being, accepted. But Israel is on high alert in the north. There is a lot going on. You know, they started drilling in various locations to look to see if there are tunnels. There are these strange buildings that have appeared 400 or 500 meters from the border in the Golan, and they believe that they may be just a front for digging, like they did along the Gaza border. We have revelations in Egypt also of them finding these new and longer borders between Gaza and Egypt, and we'll talk about that. So the situation of the Golan is very complicated. It's very testy right now because you have on the other side maneuverings going on. It's not ISIS, which is really still distant from the Golan itself, but al-Nusra is very active there, and Hezbollah. And the Iranians, the fact that when Israel struck and they killed an Iranian general from the IRGC, and that you had pictures of yesterday of an IRGC general going to visit the grave of Munia, the head of the Hezbollah group that was killed there, and the belief was that this was planning a mission to plan out an attack against Israel. The very fact that you have the presence, you see the escalating Iranian role, the buildup of missiles. Everyone knows that there are more than 100,000 missiles, but they have other new equipment, new weapons. This was the soldiers were killed. They were 2 kilometers from the border and were killed by an anti-tank rocket, which is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And it appears that they did not have an armored vehicle. And so that's something I'm sure that will become an issue at some point, if that is true. So there is an escalation. There is concern that Hezbollah or others would have an interest in raising the tension. They do not want an all-out war. They know that the support for that, both amongst Lebanese and amongst others, and even there were some courageous spokespeople in Lebanon who came out against it and spoke about the danger of the escalation. So
you got to explain that. Why would they not? Unless they're just simply not prepared for it. Is that the reason they don't want an all-out war? Because they're simply not prepared for it at this point?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is, remember, they have been bled by the fighting in Syria, where they could have a couple thousand of their men. They've lost perhaps 1,500 of their soldiers, which is a lot for Hezbollah. The people of Lebanon, they know, are very much against it because they pay the price for, you know, this kind of a conflict. So there are logistical and other reasons why they may not want to see, they don't want an all-out war. We believe that they are planning, and the new strategy, and I talked about this on the show weeks ago, which this planned attack would support, and that is that they want to penetrate, they want to try and take some territory, they want to not just use the rockets, but to go on the ground. And that's a lesson everybody learned from IS, that you have to take territory
right.
in order to put down your marker and to
make progress,
claim a somewhat of a victory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they believe they could hold on to it. So the planned attack was probably more of a terrorist-type attack. And
they save face because they retaliated the way they said they
now
would.
Now they say, look, we retaliate. They can go to their people, say they save face by what they did. Israel has to make decisions about whether they accept it. And Jihad and Nia were clearly for Hezbollah and Iran. They have upgraded the Golan operation. And I think that he commanded several dozen selected fighters. He was an expert in explosives and rockets. So that all fits why I think that the intelligence would point to the kind of strategy rather than an all-out attack.
Right. So much going on with the Israeli election, of course, and it seems more than in recent elections, maybe I've just forgotten, that the choice of who gets on the list is a big fact. I don't remember it ever being such a high-profile procedure of who gets on everybody's list. And, of course, the Naftali Bennett choice of a soccer legend in Israel caused a tremendous stir this week. Did he make a terrible mistake choosing someone like that to be on his list?
Well, he dropped out.
Oh, he's gone.
He's gone already. And what's interesting is that people on the list, how many people are opting off the list? Some saying they're doing it for Shalom Bayis, for you know, out of respect to somebody else who wanted to see. You saw the fight between with Avi Dichter over the 20th slot, which he lost ultimately, and Benny Begin now being given the 11th slot, the one that the prime minister could appoint, which was very surprising. Nobody had even mentioned his name, and he has been out of politics for a long time.
Is he accepting it?
Yes, he has.
Wow.
So the name obviously helps the ticket, but I don't think that, you know, he himself has had a big following because he's very quiet,
right.
Red and humble guy. He's
why did
politics.
Why did Caroline Glick say no to the Likud list?
You know, going into politics is not exactly the most attractive thing, and she has children to care for. She has a brilliant career as a writer.
I think we would have lost one of the best voices in journalism if she would have gone to Likud. I'm glad she didn't go.
She could continue to write. That's something.
Yeah, but it's not the same when you have skin in one specific game. You know what I mean?
Right, and everything that she said would be seen in the context it is now. Anyway, for those who want to typecast her, but also, you know, the infighting, the question of whether you have a safe seat. People don't want to be humiliated and be just the one above the cut.
Right.
You get the 17 seats and you're number 18 or
19. Right. They call it Mr. Irrelevant in the NFL draft, right? That would not be nice. Not good for your reputation if you're the last guy chosen, right? But that's up to the voters, ultimately, that they can't control, you know. They don't know. They don't know what's going to happen. At a general, I would assume your answer in terms of who's up and who's down is the same as every week, that there's no way of telling at this point what's going to happen in March.
Well, it's clearly between the two major parties. The other parties are of secondary importance. Bennett obviously still polls strongly, but Kahalon is under 10. Lieberman is 4, I think, right now. So it's between them, and they're 2 votes apart. But remember that it's not just how many votes. It's who can put together a 61-vote majority
right.
and show the president that they could do it.
There'll be no other visits, right? In other words, Netanyahu might come here in March. Well, he will be in Washington in March no matter what. The question is, you know, what his speaking schedule will be. But no other candidates will be no other major candidates will be invited to the White House, which has happened in the past, right?
It won't happen now.
That won't happen.
Especially now that this is so public. That won't happen. There was discussion of whether President Rivlin, when he was here this week, would go or would not go, but, you know, he's nonpartisan.
Is the new leader of Saudi Arabia any different from his predecessor?
Well, we have a king named Salman, you know, so we all love Salman, so it's a good sign.
A personal preference being issued on the air. I like that.
Right, so we'll get a bagel and a box.
If the name is Salman, the community's got to love it. You know, that notwithstanding, what can you tell us?
All along, everybody else's name begins with M. He's the one exception. All along, you know, it has been said, and when I was in Saudi Arabia, I heard it directly, that people said, you know, he has dementia, he has other inabilities, and yet he came in with all guns blazing. He's made some changes, including, they say, in regard to the rights of women. He has shaken up the government. He's made appointments. He removed Prince Bandar, for instance, whom we all knew as ambassador to the United States. And the succession is in place. The late king put in place the succession so it would be orderly. The question is what happens after that in the next generation when you get to the grandchildren of the king. He was, this is the last of the, of Abdulaziz's sons, I think, and there are, then you will get into the next generations. And there are also between the sons, and there are many of them, there are the Sidaris who are considered more significant and less significant descendants of the king. It depends who the mother was. So I don't think you'll see any change in policy right now. I don't think you'll see a change in oil policy, which is very important. And people are going to be looking to the next stage that will follow. But he faces real challenges. The situation in Yemen, which I know people have heard us talk about for a long time.
But every week it's
come to it, but everything came to it.
Yeah.
And they have moved even more radically against the government. They are now trying to impose a constitution where the Houthis, backed by Iran, are co-partners and, in fact, forced the president, the prime minister, to resign. So they are essentially now taking over. And they were ready to accept the demands for government sharing. Here they defeated the government and the guards around the presidential palace, all of this within 2 days, 3 days. The negotiations that are going on now, I understand, are not going very well. So they face that challenge. They face Iran's intervention inside the country. They are obviously very concerned about the Iran nuclear program. So the king faces serious issues, and I think he's trying to keep the domestic scene tranquil and focused then on these issues. But his big move, I think, will be more in terms of the domestic agenda.
Did you find it unusual that Jordan is negotiating for its downed pilot, a prisoner of ISIS, when we really haven't seen ISIS negotiate with anybody to this point?
Yes, in a sense. But I think what the Jordanians are trying to do is find out if he's alive. They're trying to... The deadline has passed, and they have not yet released the woman, the terrorist, who ISIS wants. I think they believe the pilot is, in fact, dead. Mm. And that therefore are participating in this. But they also have to show that they didn't slam the door. In Japan, the parents of the Japanese who's held are saying if he's killed, it's because of the king. The king has responsibility. He does not. It's ISIS's responsibility. We shouldn't divert attention from it. But you see that they are escalating their activities, that they, in fact, can... almost appear to be a legitimate party with which to negotiate.
Yeah, boy.
These are brutal terrorists. And look what they said this week about how they called on Muslims around the world in the West to carry out attacks. And they praised the attacks in France, Canada, Belgium, Australia, mentioning it by name, which leads you to believe that, in fact, they either had a role or some subsidiary role, but certainly the very fact that they are supporting and calling for more and more attacks tells you that you can't negotiate. There has to be an all-out response to them. And the fact is that they are holding on to territories. They lost Kobani in Syria to Kurds and with the support of the coalition bombers, American bombers in particular. but they've had other victories in Syria, and they continue to hold a significant territory in Iraq and Syria.
They did murder one Japanese prisoner, right? Wasn't
they
there?
Killed one.
A beheading?
Yes.
A beheading on tape?
And they're beheading people. We see it. Look at the attacks in the Sinai, in the northern Sinai, where scores of people, more 26 killed in one day, and then in Alexandria today, I think Alexandria, they killed 9 people in a bus bombing. But they have people who set up roadblocks, IS people, and then they summarily exit, behead people if they think that they are a collaborator with the Egyptian government.
My point was, remember the days when beheading was dramatic and it actually caught the attention of the world?
That is my point. Exactly. Right. It's become commonplace and nobody cares anymore. It's become so widespread. I said this maybe a month ago or more, that the dumbing down of values, the fact that it's not only not a source of abhorrence and shock, but it becomes a major recruiting tool, that they continue and other groups are doing it because they see that it works, that you can get away with it, and what they're doing in Syria, we don't know the full story. We may never know. We see how the new story about the CIA arms going awry with the units, whole units that America's trained and we invested in, turned over to the IS brigades. So you see that their appeal continues. And they're complaining that they don't get enough arms. And America's saying, look, you can't just have an open spigot of arms, because we see that it goes over to the other side. And the overall, the situation in Syria is too strange about who's supporting Assad. Do they want Assad out? Do they not want Assad out?
Right.
That the rebels took a key base near Damascus, in one of the fortified zones that is an approach to Damascus. And yet in other areas, they are being beaten back.
What do you think of Michelle Obama and her appearance being criticized in the Middle East?
You know, this is, I really don't like this gossipy stuff, because we have so many serious issues.
Yeah, but I'm not asking from a gossipy point of view. Was it a mistake in terms of the way, I mean, should the United States protocol have prepared her in a different manner, or this should not have been expected to be an insult or make waves in Middle Eastern media?
Well, it appears to be a statement by her, and that would, you know, that of course would rile the royals,
right.
Rile the royals. So, but I'm not sure that was the case. It may be that she just felt that as a Westerner coming there. I don't know that the others in the party, did Nancy Pelosi, Rice, did they all cover their heads? Did they not? So. I think when Western visitors come, if it's in a religious, this was not a religious ceremony, this was just a Shiva call, because he was buried right away. It's Muslim tradition. So this was more of a social event than it was a religious event.
Malcolm.
And, you know, it's interesting, because if people knew that the king really disliked Obama and has expressed those views, and now... Achrayim Mos Kedoshim, and where everybody after that everybody gets sanctified, and the question that's being raised is, why a big delegation? Why did the president, you know, bring all these people over, members of Congress, others, members of the administration? Obviously, the relationship with Saudi Arabia is very important, and he wants to get off on the right foot with King Salman. But ultimately, it's going to come back to the policies, especially about Iran, and the willingness of America to draw the line and take clear positions is really going to be what will win them or lose them.
Please note, Malcolm compared us to one of those ratings-grabbing gossip shows. Everybody, please note that. That'll come back to haunt them in a future program, I guarantee you.
I didn't say you. I said I know.
From a couple of our discussions. First of all, you mentioned, obviously, it was a big story last week, and I thank you for bringing it up. The Amiya bombing, a prosecutor. The suspicion is, of course, he was murdered. I don't know if you read it. Did you read the account of the Haaretz reporter who escaped Argentina?
Of course.
That was unbelievable. Anyway, people asked me the simple question that I didn't ask you last week. I think the answer is no. The prosecutor was not Jewish, correct?
I think he may have been Jewish.
Oh, might he have been Jewish?
But the last report I got from somebody was that, in fact, he may have been Jewish. Jewish.
But one way or the other, that's irrelevant, right?
Completely irrelevant. Right. And there are many relevant things to this. And if you remember, I said, and I went on the air that night, and I said, Nisman is not somebody, and I met him, I hosted him here in New York, we worked with him on the case, on his efforts, was not somebody I think was likely to have committed to commit suicide, especially not on the eve, literally hours before his most important testimony of his whole life, to Congress on a report that he worked on for 10 years. I think the fact that the president's response was to dismantle the intelligence unit, rather than an all-out campaign to find out who's responsible. She first said it was suicide, the evidence of suicide. I said it wasn't, and I heard from people in Buenos Aires saying to me that there was another door to the apartment. As it turns out, there was. There was an Iranian agent in Buenos Aires at the time. There was no powder marks on his hand, so if he had shot it, obviously that would have been necessary. They claimed that the door was locked from the inside. Now, locksmith says, well, that's not the key issue. This is a really amazingly courageous man. He's been harassed, and he had 10 security guards. How could they not have prevented this happening? Why was nobody around when the attack took place against him? And especially on the eve, the night of his...
And he was always suspicious of those security guards.
And we know that Iran, the people are named, and it seems now that his evidence was that the president and the foreign minister, Timmerman, who was coming here to New York soon, were involved in an effort to immunize the Iranians in exchange for an oil deal, which they would probably have benefited or alleged a benefit from as well. But certainly the trade-off here, and I think that the Congress and others have to, and the administration have to press the Argentinians. They have. I mean, they obviously have been supportive of the effort to get to the truth on this. But, he wrote a 300-page criminal complaint. There's plenty of evidence in there. And we know that the people, including Larijani, leaders of Iran, who are named, and the Iranians were saying, and now there are accusations the American government may have played a role in it, to try and ameliorate some of the charges against them.
Right.
And the very fact that this took place when we're commemorating the 70th anniversary of liberation of Auschwitz, when we're looking at a country that had whole units just to bring Nazis, to save Nazis and bring them to Argentina after the war. And in that larger picture, those who saw and watched the commemoration at Auschwitz this year, which was not a Jewish event, it was shamefully not Jewish until Ronald Lauder made this remarkable, really remarkable, challenging speech to the 40 leaders, countries leaders who were there. But we see that now in Greece, the new defense minister is supposedly an anti-Semite. We see the comments by others, some countries, with like the Hungarian prime minister talking about the shameful role in the Holocaust, and yet we're seeing the rise of extremist parties. Merkel talked about the warning that the threats to the Jews, and so some of the leaders took, courageous, forthright positions. But at the same time, every country that's reporting, Britain, France, are reporting record levels of anti-Semitism, that 50-60% or 40-50% in some countries of the violent acts against Jews, who are 1% of the population. When almost 60% of Germans say they want to put the Holocaust behind them. These are things people have to look at very seriously, that there are messages in it. The election in Greece, with Golden Dawn remaining the third party, it's a neo-Nazi party, and some of the people who are being appointed are associated with racist things. They're a delegate to the EU. One of them is supposedly a neo-Nazi. They use Nazi imagery, the Golden Dawn itself. And this all, at the same time, is commemorating 70 years of the Shoah and all the lessons that everybody says we learn, and never again when we see it's happening again.
Oh, no question about that. And back to Senator Menendez for a moment. So earlier this week when I encouraged people to call his office to voice complaints about the postponement of the bill, the truth is that's somewhat improper. We should still be calling and encouraging and thanking him at this point, right?
We should be encouraging him. We should be encouraging his colleague. It's not to beat up on them, but to encourage them to come out publicly now and say, not only will they support the bill, but they will support an override if, in fact, there is no deal by that time. It's an important message to the Iranians that they see it and that they understand that this is not going to be obfuscated. It's going to be postponed. There are going to be more sanctions at a time when their economy is obviously being impacted by it. And that while it's continuing to support activities, that they are, the Iranians are supporting Hamas, for instance. Yesterday they graduated 15,000 people from training camps, kids between from 15 to adults of 21. They're called Pioneers of the Resistance. They went through this training camp to become terrorists to fight against Israel. That Iran is in no way holding back its activities, certainly vis-a-vis Hezbollah. We see it. They had this 27-meter-long missile that was revealed. And they talk about their strategy against the United States. And it's why the message has to be, it's not just the nuclear program, the ballistic missile program, the fact that they have, 20, 30 of these little midget submarines. They can close the Straits of Hormuz. They now can act through Houthi against the Straits in Bab al-Mandab in Yemen. So they can threaten American shipping. 20% of the oil to the West goes through it every day. They have, and they have this to the terrorist network to complement it, and these non-state terrorist groups like Hezbollah, and many others that they can. And we saw what they did both in the Amia, the attack in Argentina, then and Bulgaria more recently abroad. They can attack in the region, and I think we have to help educate, and this is not Israel's battle. This is not legislation for Israel. It's legislation to support for America's security. It's the West that's going to pay a price. It's the Europeans. Everybody will pay a price if they are allowed to move ahead. And so they're in link with North Korea, and more of that has come out. Something we talked about years ago about the joint effort that they're engaged in developing nuclear weapons. We saw it in Syria. We saw it in other places.
So, all right. We got to wrap up. Malcolm, we're wrapping. All right. Malcolm, thank you. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week.
Have a good Shabbos. And next week from Jerusalem.
There you go. We always love hearing that. Malcolm Hohnlein live from Yerushalayim next week. Noted, folks. Make sure to be tuned in.